Our main speaker tonight is Julia.
My name is Julia, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's really good to be here. I'm really nervous. I'm really moved to look around and to hear all the people counting days and to think that there are like 450 people together here in this church, and that we're, most of us are alcoholics, and that we all can't stop drinking on our own, and yet we're all sober. And, you know, how big of a miracle is that? Kate said that this is a safe place, and I want to thank you, Kate, for saying that, because it is really a safe place. And, you know, I'm nervous, and it's, you know, how like an alcoholic to turn something that's all about love into fear. And, you know, there's nothing, there's absolutely nothing to be frightened of. I mean, I'm telling that to myself here. Let's see where to start. I feel like there's really so much that I want to say, and I want to talk fast. My story gets longer, and I've got to tell at least parts of all of it. So start with some facts. I've been sober for 22, I guess nearly and a half years. My sobriety date is September 26th, 1986. I had a slip 4 days of my first year, so I actually got here in 1985. September 2nd, 1985 was my original date. And then I didn't stay sober. I went out for about a month. Let go of the mic. Let go of the mic. Okay. Do not take off the jacket and let go of the mic. Okay. My sponsor says, do not take off the jacket. I wonder why. That I understand, but why I have to let go of the mic, I don't really understand. But I'll trust the process and the group conscience. you'll tell me later about the mic, because I'm seriously curious. Oh, recording. Oh, thanks for reminding me. Okay. I wasn't even thinking about that before. I'd completely forgotten about that. I had a birthday last week, and I actually turned 49. So I'm beginning my 50th year, and like I said, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 25. So I've really been here for basically half my life. And the miracle has already happened. Hundreds of miracles have already happened. I have nothing to prove. I've done my homework. I do not have to be nervous. I'm going to say that one more time. Okay. So I'll start with the beginning. I had my first real drink, my first drunk, when I was 11 years old. I stayed away as long as I could, and I made it till I was 11. And I was ready. That drink went down like nectar, like honey. I went from childhood to adulthood. I feel like my life, my experience went from black and white to color. I went from normal, kind of scrawny, scared, nervous kid who couldn't dance at a party to Gone with the Wind, Scarlett O'Hara, epic emotion. Alcohol agrees with me. I have a body that was geared to accept and to love and to run with alcohol. That I look back on that night, and it still, in memory, seems like one of the best nights of my life. I had a great time, and what was so great about it was that I could feel. The cat brought in a little baby rabbit who was dead, and I cried for that rabbit. And I don't think I had ever had emotion like that, you know, that big kind of compassion about life. And I loved it, and I had one drink, and then I had to have another drink, and I had to have another drink, and another drink. I don't think my friends drank as much as I did. And the night ended on the floor of a white-tiled bathroom which was cool, and there was a great porcelain toilet bowl, which was also cool, near my cheek, and the room was spinning. And that was the night. Then the next morning, I had a hangover. I was in the candy kitchen in Bridgehampton drinking coffee and feeling like a grown-up. And that was the first one. It's a progressive illness, they told me when I made it to the hospital in 1985. And it was definitely a progressive illness for me. You know, I was 11. It was 1971. The 60s, you know, were in the air. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I went with it. I completely went with it. I don't want to tell, you know, too much of the sort of middle part, but, you know, like I said, it progressed. And by the time I was 23, I was really drinking against my will. And by that, I mean that I was, you know, making promises that I couldn't keep. At the time, I had a boyfriend whom I loved and who loved me and who wasn't exactly one of us. He was also a bit older than I was, so he wasn't really in the mood for nightclubbing till all hours. So I would say, you know, so-and-so's playing at the Peppermint Lounge. I'm going to the first set. I'll be back by midnight. And I'd go to the club, and I'd hear the band, and I'd be drinking, and, you know, midnight would come, and it would not quite be time to go home, so I'd call him, and I'd say, well, you know, I'm going to leave really soon. You know, I should be there by 1. And then it would be 1 o'clock, and there would be more drinks, you know, and there would be other substances that shall go unnamed. And then it was 1:30, and I'd be calling home, and I'd say, I'm leaving now. I'm really sorry. And he'd be angry, and I couldn't leave. I just couldn't leave. I could not leave the club. I wanted to leave the club. I could not leave the club. It's 2 o'clock. You know, it's too late to call. It's 3 o'clock. The club's closed. It's after hours. You know, it's 4. It's 5. Now, you know, the people are coming home or going to work, and I haven't made it home yet. And, you know, it's hideous. I mean, it's hideous. And I'm guilty. I'm ashamed. I finally get home. You know, I climb the stairs. The elevator was always broken in that building, so I climb the stairs, and I get up there, and he's mad. He was a painter, and, you know, he's sort of, like, cleaning his brushes from the night before and making breakfast, and he won't talk to me, and I'm there like, oh, I'm really sorry, I'm really sorry. And, you know, it's horrible, 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 horrible. And then that night, I'm telling him, you know, I promise I'll never do it again. I'm so sorry. I love you. That was really irresponsible. You know, I'll never do it again. He forgives me. Kiss and make up. Everything's fine. You know, the next day, make it an early night. The day after that, now it's 8 o'clock. I look in the voice and, oh, so-and-so, you know, somebody else is playing, you know, at a different club. And it's like, oh, fine. You know, let's go. I'll, you know, first set. I promise I'll be home by midnight. You know, and I just couldn't do it. I could not leave. I could not keep my word, even though everything in me wanted to. It was miserable, the, you know, most of the end of those nights. But yet, I just could not keep my word. So it wasn't too long after that that I ended up, you know, hearing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, things got pretty bad. I was basically living on booze. By the time I got to the hospital, I had, you know, no white blood cells because I just, like, wasn't eating. I was literally surviving on the calories from alcohol. I was staying up for days and days. I was really, 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 really sick. And it's kind of amazing because, I mean, you look at me now, like, I'm unrecognizable. The person that you see standing before you is unrecognizable from where this thing took me. So I ended up in the hospital, and, you know, it was there that I heard the message of AA, and a miracle happened, which is that I did not have to pick up another drink. Extraordinary thing happened, and it was lost on me. It was completely lost on me. This miracle had happened, and I just totally took it for granted. I went to a halfway house. I came back. I left the halfway house AMA. I came back to New York. And I went to downtown meetings, and I wanted to talk a little bit about my slip. Can you do me a favor? I wanted to tell the story. I don't usually tell it. Thank you. But I think it's sort of good to tell, because there are a lot of newcomers here. And, you know, you all are members of the Atlantic Group, or at least attend the Atlantic Group. So I know you hear good stuff all the time, you know, and don't be around people, places, and things. When you're new, is certainly a really good suggestion. I didn't take that suggestion because I thought I knew better. And for about a year, I did know better. I was hanging out with my old friends. I was playing music. And it was true. I didn't pick up. And everyone who was saying I was going to pick up, you know, were wrong, except for this one night. So what happened was I was I was sitting there, you know, just like I had done over the past year, you know, and we were playing music and, you know, we stopped playing and we're sitting around. And I was in AA. I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew that I could not take a drink or any other substance with safety. I knew that. I thought I had surrendered. I had a sponsor. I even had a home group. I was going to meetings, you know, more or less, I mean, as well as I could. And I knew in my mind that if I picked up a drink, that I would become a fiend and a pig. You know, I knew that. It wasn't like I thought, oh, it's going to be different. No, no, no. So I'm sitting there, right? And so there was a mirror with a certain substance, which shall remain nameless, which was coming around my way. And when it was, you know, where Peggy is now, I was an alcoholic who could not drink or do anything like that safely. And I was in AA. This was in my head. And then the thing got here, and it was like somebody else picked up that straw and did that thing. Like, boom. No thought. I've had many sponsors, like Kate. I've been really blessed to have many sponsors in this program. And one of them has this great line about the brontosaurus, whose head is so tiny and so far away from its tail that it literally, I guess scientists believe, needed a separate nerve ganglia at the base of its tail to control its tail. Because, like, it's, you know, the distance is so great. So she contends that alcoholics have a separate nerve ganglia in our elbows where we just, like, go like that, you know? And that's exactly what happened to me. I mean, they say you can't get struck drunk, but it's kind of, I sort of was, you know? And in the book, you know, he talks about that, that, you know, sometimes, you know, there will be no thought at all. And that, you know, I've got no effective mental defense. I don't want to give away this week's thumper stumper, but that was last week's. That, you know, I have no effective mental defense against that first drink, you know. And like I said, I knew that I couldn't do this, that this was a really bad idea, but yet somehow I did it anyway. And that's powerlessness. You know, he writes over and over again that self-will and self-knowledge will avail me nothing. And, you know, that really has been my experience. I want to fast forward and just say that, you know, basically after that slip, I was really blessed to, about 9 months back, get a great sponsor who, you know, came from a great sponsorship lineage. That was Kennedy F., and her sponsor was Lorna K., at that time. And these women loved the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they really gave me that. They believed that, and I'm going to talk about this because there are so many people here counting days, you know, they really encouraged me to sit in the front row. Kennedy would say, draw your chair close to the hearth of AA. And, you know, she was right, because I knew, you know, from all the rock shows I'd attended that, you know, being in the front is much better than being at the back, you know, and I was willing to fight my way to the front, you know, at shows. And so why not here? You know, it's like sit in the front. And they really believed in doing service. And I remember thinking, you know, you don't understand. I hate myself. It is horrible to be me. It is painful to go into the Korean deli and, you know, buy a sandwich. I can't do the laundry. I can't shop for clothes. I have gained 50% of my body weight. I am a whale, okay? I can't look in the mirror. I'm consumed with self-hatred. And you're telling me that making coffee at a meeting is going to help me? You're telling me that, you know, getting being a secretary at Sunday Night Soho, you know, you don't understand. What I need is ACOA therapy. You know, I need John Bradshaw, you know, I need a shrink, you know, and they said, no, you know, you need to do service, because if you do service at the group, you'll know other people who are doing service at the group, and you'll be drawn into the center of things, and to trust the group, and to throw in my towel with you guys, and to be part of the group, and the group was what was going to, was what was going to keep me sober, and I followed her suggestions about sitting in the front row, calling her every day, not picking up a drink, being willing to do service, being willing to read the literature, being willing to try to work the steps. And after about 2 months, I felt just a little bit better. And I got it that there was a power greater than myself, because none of those ideas were my ideas, and I didn't believe they would work. But I did what you guys, what she, what they, what you were telling me to do, and I felt like this little pilot light go on in my soul, and I was a little better. So it was a brilliant, brilliant sponsorship lineage that they had, and I managed to, I was given 5 years of sobriety, basically. I meanwhile had gotten another sponsor, had done some 9 steps, felt a bit better, and as soon as I felt better, I completely took my will back. And again, I think this is really important to talk about, because alcoholism is, you know, not something that I had back when I was drinking. Alcoholism is something that I have today. The disease is centered in the mind, not in the body. So I haven't had a drink for 22 years, but when I was sitting there consumed with fear, I call that alcoholism. That's untreated alcoholism, like that insanity, that like it's so important what I say. You know what I mean? Like all of that. There's a million ways to describe it, but it's spiritual sickness. It's forms of self that beleaguer me viciously. And, you know, it's a human problem, yes. You know, maybe alcoholics have it more than other people, maybe not. But we have to find a cure for it on a daily basis, because if we have that kind of self-obsession, finally life gets so miserable that why not drink? So, you know, I'm kind of skipping around here, but I mean, really cut to the chase here, I was re-sponsored. I was self-will run riot, and maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that, but I was taken through the book by somebody who's here tonight and who really saved my life by carrying that message and having the time to sponsor me and impart to me, transmit to me what the essence of our program is and what the nature of my illness is as it's written in the book. And, you know, basically what those first 100 found as a cure for alcoholism is gaining access to a power greater than my ego. I've got to find this, because like I was saying, if I'm prey to my ego, you know, first of all, I can't remember why it was such a bad idea to pick up that drink. So, you know, like I'm a dead duck, just on the level of the active disease. You know, when I stop, I can't remember why it was a bad idea to start. And when I start, I can't stop. So when I'm starting and I'm not stopping, I'm a complete pig and I'm dangerous and I'm driving drunk and, you know, everything. And so it's, you know, I'm really in danger. You know, but meanwhile, even on the dry side, I have no power over the negativity. And I can be, you know, and I have been many years away from a drink and have done stuff that is just as crazy, pretty much, as the stuff that I did when I was out there. And, you know, again, I think it's really important to like, say this for people that haven't been around a long time. You know, like, it, you know, it's like the insanity doesn't necessarily end just because you haven't had a drink. I mean, that's been my experience. I like to say I didn't pick up a drink, but I picked up a drinker. And let me tell you, that was a trip through the briar patch. I don't recommend it. And it seemed like a really good idea at the time. You know, it really did. And here I, you know, at that time I was maybe 12 years sober, I want to say. And I was, you know, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought. The steps were things that I had done in the past. And, you know, I had a lot to say about them, if you ask me. But, you know, they were things that I had done, not principles that I was living in today. And, you know, I hadn't had a drink or anything else. I was hanging out with people who were sober. But yet I was so far away from any kind of surrender, any kind of admission or recognition of alcoholism in that I had it, any kind of conception of a power greater than myself that was going to restore me to sanity. I was so lost. And, you know, here was this, like, beautiful young man who was totally hot, who was a great guitar player, and, you know, who like, had this, you know, the first time we kissed and I smelt the back of his neck, you know, and he smelt like a beautiful melange of Budweiser, sweat, and sort of machine oil, you know, and it was like the most beautiful smell I'd ever smelled. It was probably JJ, you know, I'm just kidding. But, you know, it wasn't JJ, but, I fell in love, and I just thought, you know, I knew he was one of us, and that he was drinking, and I thought it was appealing. Can you imagine? After hundreds, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, of hearing all of you talk about when you were active and how bad you were to your husbands and lovers and mothers and sisters, you know, I was like, oh, this is going to be different. It's going to be different for me. You know, this is going to be great. And I'm skiing down the mountain, you know, and the red flags, I see them coming, and I'm like slaloming by those red flags, you know. And then, like, you know, and then I got pregnant. And let me tell you, you know, I started hitting some of those red flags. And it wasn't fun. But, you know, the end of the story is actually really good. You know, I'm sort of looping and folding around here, but like I said, I about 6 years ago, I met this new sponsor, and the backstory to that is that after our son was 2 years old, I reached this very quiet kind of bottom. You know, the world ends with a whimper, not with a bang. And my sponsor said, "Do a 90 and 90." I was furious at the father of my child, and I couldn't write a four step, and I started praying. No conception of God whatsoever. But I started in my room saying the seven-step prayer every night. And I said to the air in the room, "I am now willing that you have all of me, good and bad. Please now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows." And nothing happened. There was no big surge, no oceanic feeling, nothing. But about 2 months later, or something like that, three months later, I discovered that Kevin H., who's here tonight, occasionally works with women. And so I asked him if he would take me through the book and if he would work with me. I didn't know what it meant then. And he did. And for 5 months, he was my sponsor. And, you know, he gave me this thing. And this thing that all of you were talking about the whole time, but I just couldn't hear it. I just didn't understand what the mental illness was. And that I have it, and that I have it today, and that I can't rely on my ego as a guidance system for my life. You know, your ego is not your amigo. And I was living in my, you know, I was living in my head and believing all the things that it told me, and it just is not a reliable narrator. My ego is an unreliable narrator. So the inexorable conclusion of the book is that I have to find this power. So, you know, one of Kevin's sponsors has this great thing about, you could be happy in 5 minutes if you really want to be. My troubles are of my own making. The best promise in the book. You don't have to change in order for me to be happy. It's self-will. It's forms of self. 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, and so forth. And I'm driven to step on the toes of others. So I got that, and I started applying those principles. And I realized about 3 years into this process that I was writing inventory, and I was writing the same inventory about my mother and about the father of my child. And after 3 years of writing the inventory, you know, she would say, you know, I'd be in the middle of a sentence, she'd say, "Your teeth are yellow," you know, and I'd be like devastated, you know, write it out, you know, write the resentment out, you know, just the same niggly stuff, and I'd write it out, and I'd get relief, you know, I'd quiet the disturbance, and I'd get relief, but then, you know, next week, it's, you know, "Here, I gave you a silk Hermes scarf that's the color of, I don't know, Russian dressing," and I'd be like, "You don't know who I am, you think I'd like that scarf, you don't even know me, and you're my own mother," and, you know, I'd spiral, you know, and I'd have to go up, and I'd have to write the inventory. After 3 years of the almost daily application of that tool, the relationships changed, and the buttons were no longer there. And she could give me a present, I would say thank you. Miraculous. I don't know how much time I have. Not too much, but I wanted to talk. Oop, 5 minutes. Not good. I wanted to talk really quickly, I guess, about her, because she died on October 13th, and she was my nemesis. She was the reason that everything that was wrong with me was wrong. Everything was her fault. She was like the bright star, and I made myself the dark star. And she was an extraordinary woman. And, you know, I'm so glad that she was my mother. Because of this program, that relationship was healed. It took a lot of inventory writing. It took a direct amend. And then about a year later, this Tibetan monk said, look, whatever she says, you just say yes. And I started saying yes. She said, let's reorganize the library. I said, okay. Not, listen, I'm going to the beach. I'm going to yoga. They're your books. You know, my attitude was, you know, here was this house full of books. They weren't my books. You know, why should I reorganize them? You know, meanwhile, this woman was getting ready to leave me this house and these magnificent books. And I was there, like, as a, you know, 40-something-year-old teenager with this, like, adolescent alcoholic attitude of, you know, they're not mine. I mean, come on. You know, and this was the stuff that I would try to sell you as, like, valid, you know, insanity. So anyway, I came to my senses. I started saying yes. I started acting like a normal person. You know, we're not talking sainthood here. We're talking normal, okay? Yes, I would like to help you. So I helped her, you know, as much as I could. And the relationship resolved. She got very, very sick in June. She was non-compos mentis, basically. 4 days before she died, I was sitting in a meeting, and she was really out of it. It was her birthday. It also happened to be Rosh Hashanah, which we don't celebrate, but is the day of atonement, is the day of the erasing of all debt. And I was sitting there and in this meeting in the O'Toole building on 12th Street and 7th Avenue, and I looked at the sky, and I had this experience of her energy, of her consciousness, her presence flowing into me from the sky. And the feeling was this absolute unconditional love. Like, you're all right, kid. You're 100% all right. And the feeling was that she received everything that I had been able to give to her. And that I could receive everything that she had been given to me. You know, her intelligence, her beauty, her love, her ideas, you know, this house that she would leave me. And that I could receive that and really use it. That I could take the show on the road. And that the debt was completely forgiven. That it was completely healed. And when she died, I was there. And that same feeling was in the room. And I really think, I mean, I don't know, but I think it was her. I think it was the unconditional love that really had always been there, that I had not been able to receive. I had only heard the criticism. And behind every comment of, you know, your teeth are yellow or whatever, you know, here's the scarf, there was only love. You know, I heard it as an insult, but it really was, I love you, and I want you to be beautiful. You know, that's all she ever said to me. And because of this program, you know, that relationship really has been healed. And, you know, I just have to say that it's such an ongoing process here in AA for me that, you know, I can be, like, rocketed to the fourth dimension and have this spiritual life and have conscious contact and be so, you know, full of this collective energy, this redemptive energy that is here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and yet have a sort of bottom going on. You know, at the same time that I'm not yet able to see. And then when I'm ready, I can recognize that. My mother left some money to a cousin of mine against whom I've had a resentment. And I discovered in the summer that this particular cousin was in trouble financially. And because of my resentment, I just didn't tell this person that they had this great gift coming. I know Peggy's gasping. It's really bad. And, you know, and then, you know, my mother died, and it's several months later, and I've not called this cousin. And the lawyer is saying, give me the social security numbers of these people. And like today, Sunday, I'm finally getting like, oh my God, I got to write this out. You know, why haven't I called this person? And what I find in the inventory is extraordinary sludge. Jealousy, like the only child thing, not wanting to, I mean, it's not that I don't want to give her the money, but when she was around with my mother, not wanting to share, you know, fear of competition. Just you pick up the rock but it's, you know, it's garden variety human being stuff. And so, you know, I get to write out the 8-step, you know, I get to make the 9-step, and, you know, and it's all going to be okay. And, you know, I'm no different from anyone else. I'm no different from any of you. We all have basically the same inventory. So, you know, I'm really grateful to be sober. I'm really grateful for the program and the fellowship. I'm grateful for this group. You know, you guys really rock it here. You really know how to make AA, like, fabulous. And it is fabulous. So the Atlantic Group really reflects that. And thank you for listening.